Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host a Courthouse Steps preview webinar on Little v. Hecox and West Virginia v. BBJ, featuring Jonathan Scruggs. Jonathan serves as Senior Counsel and Vice President of Litigation Strategy with Alliance Defending Freedom. In this role, he identifies new litigation opportunities, develops legal strategies, and improves processes across multiple litigation teams. Since joining ADF in 2006, Jonathan has worked on and prevailed in a variety of cases relating to Title IX, gender ideology, and people's right to freely express their faith, including Masterpiece Cake Shop v. Colorado Civil Rights Commission, 303 Creative v. Alanis, and Brush and Nib Studio v. Phoenix. Our moderator today is Sarah Parshall Perry. Sarah is Vice President and Legal Fellow at Defending Education. Before Defending Education, she was a Senior Legal Fellow in the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. She's also served as Senior Counsel to the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Education. She also frequently appears on numerous national and international media outlets and has testified multiple times for the U.S. House Judiciary Committee. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions are those of the speakers. With that, Sarah, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thanks, Marco. Well, thanks to everybody who's joined us online. This is a series of cases that I think a lot of us have a keen interest in. And at the close of what many consider to be a very high profile term, last go around with everything from gender medicine bans for minors coming out of particular states to so-called ghost gun bans to Medicaid funding for abortion, free speech and the First Amendment. These were sort of a series of very high profile cases. But right at the end of the term, the Supreme Court decided to grant cert in two marquee cases for this term, no doubt, Hecox versus Little and West Virginia versus BPJ. Now, the Supreme Court is going to consider in these cases whether state bans on natal men and women's scholastic athletics violate Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972 and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So to my mind, but I have a tremendous guest with me who knows this issue better than just about anyone. To my mind, the answer based on the court's textualist and originalist jurisprudence, both recent and historical, is yes, but I'd like to get Jonathan's take on this. But a little bit of background on these cases, like 25 other states, West Virginia and Idaho enacted laws mandating that participation in women's scholastic athletics be limited to biological females. It thereby eliminated participation of so-called transgender females who are biologically male. Now, in West Virginia, after preliminarily enjoining the sports law, a district court later upheld it at summary judgment, dissolving its prior injunction. The Fourth Circuit, based on some previous Fourth Circuit precedent that we'll probably touch on today, reversed in April of 2024, holding that the sports law likely violated Title IX and the Equal Protection Clause as well. It determined that the statute discriminated based on both sex and gender identity, recognized gender identity as a protected class, and then applied intermediate scrutiny, the level of judicial review required for sex-based classifications under the law, to just the male plaintiff. Relying on the Supreme Court's 2020 decision, Bostock versus Clayton County, from which I would argue that much violence has been done in the field of anti-discrimination law, the Fourth Circuit majority also interpreted Title IX to encompass not just protections based on sex, but also those based on gender identity. So the state was therefore required to allow the participation of the transgender athlete. In Idaho, a district court enjoined its law for violating the Equal Protection Clause, and on appeal, the Ninth Circuit affirmed And the court held that Idaho's definition of sex was discriminatory, asserting that sex is determined by perceived internal gender identity rather than biological sex, and then went further, dismissing concerns of fairness in athletic competition, noting the rarity of transgender athletes in women's sports, and stressing ultimately the availability of hormone suppression, which could conceivably mute certain athletic advantages of natal men. So similar posturing coming out of two states, two state bans on natal men in women's scholastic athletics. I'm joined today by Jonathan Scruggs, as we previously mentioned. And my initial question to you, Jonathan, is whether these cases are ultimately carbon copies of one another, or are there unique sort of posturings of both of these particular cases?
Yeah, there are definitely some similarities, but there are some slight differences. The laws are pretty similar. There's some small differences. For example, Idaho's law applies from CAPE all the way through 12. West Virginia's goes from 7th all the way up to college. And then I think the biggest difference is the Hecox case out of the Ninth Circuit only deals with equal protection, whereas the BPJ case deals with both equal protection and Title IX. So I think that's one reason the court took both these cases up, is really to make sure that they're hitting all the issues, because you have, in one situation, you have a plaintiff who is in college, a male who identifies as female trying to play at a university. But in the other case, you have someone who's now in high school. So you've got different ages, different grade levels, and somewhat different legal arguments. But when you put it all together, they're very similar cases and really tee up the major issue of how do we define sex in Title IX? And then also, how do we define sex for equal protection purposes under the 14th Amendment, and how those analyses should work in each context?
Yeah. And a lot of these claims, obviously, the Title IX and the equal protection claims often appear together in cases involving these sort of transgender athlete bans or even separation of bathrooms by biological sex. We'll touch on that in a little bit as well. Both of the cases in the Fourth Circuit and the 11th Circuit, relative to the bathroom issue itself, the Title IX and the equal protection issues did appear simultaneously. So let's kind of take them piece by piece. Let's talk first about Title IX. Obviously, we have some history here. We've been playing a bit of regulatory ping pong between the Biden administration and the Trump administration. You know, his sort of parting salvo when it came to the Obama administration through the Department of Education was essentially an informal directive to every educational stakeholder to open all bathrooms to any individual, regardless of gender identity or biological sex. That was obviously summarily reversed under Trump 45. Then we saw rulemaking clarifying some specifics under Title IX. That rule, once the Biden administration took office, was put on hold, unfortunately, and a new rule after rescission was recreated. We went through the process then of seeing some different modifications of Title IX, the most significant of which, and germane to the purposes of this discussion, is the expansion of sex to include gender identity or transgender status. Now, the court obviously relied on Bostock versus Clayton County. We can talk about that again. This is one of those cases for which, you know, I think that a lot of violence has been done in the field of civil rights law specifically. But Bostock versus Clayton County has provided the platform for the previous administration to expand rule in Title IX to include participation in athletic teams, in bathrooms based on gender identity and not just biological sex. That doesn't seem to be, based on the plain text and implementing regulations, to be supported by the actual law itself. What's your take?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. You have a massive expansion of Bostock starting. I mentioned even before with you that I wrote my first letter about the bathroom issue in 2014. And we've been going back and forth, ping-ponging about this issue. I'm actually hopeful that this case will finally resolve it once for all, is what does sex mean in Title IX? And I think the most important thing, if you just take a step back, and we can talk about the sub-arguments, but if you take a step back, it really makes little sense to apply Bostock in the Title IX context, because everyone admits that Title IX allows various sex distinctions. Yeah. And just as a thought experiment, imagine if you're at a law firm, right? And the law firm said, hey, we're going to have our bankruptcy group only be men, and our, you know, malpractice group only be women. That would violate Title VII because sex is not relevant for employment. That was one of the key findings in Bostock. Yeah. And one reason why Bostock said, hey, we're not going to apply to bath. They're not going to say anything about bathrooms. Well, but the reality of it is in Title IX, you have to be sex conscious because Title IX says you have to provide equal opportunities for sports. And starting way back when in 1974 with the Javits Amendment that directed the agency to issue regulations about sports, it's been the widespread acceptance that schools have not only can be sex conscious and allowing sex-separated sports teams, but many times they have to be in order to provide equal opportunity. And so there have been many cases at the lower courts, for example, when a male athlete filed a lawsuit, said it violated Title IX equal protection because the school got rid of the men's teams, for example, in order to provide more opportunities for women. And all those cases ruled against the plaintiff, saying that the male has no right essentially to be on the women's team or have, their own separate sports because they can always participate in another male sport. So the point being is that Title IX by itself has to be sex conscious. That's the only way to operate and maintain showers, bathrooms, overnight accommodations, and of course sports, because, and I think this is relatively undisputed, everyone agrees that physiological differences matter for sports. That's just common sense. And we can talk a little bit about that. Ironically, the plaintiffs in both these cases, they don't object in theory to sex distinctions as a general matter in sports. They essentially argue that the definition of sex or the definition of what is a woman has to include them, even though they are males who identify as females. So that could kind of set the overarching framework why it's just a common sense matter. It's just not possible to apply that Bostock analysis of you have to be sex blind in the Title IX context.
Yeah. Yeah. And the implementing regulations, as you noted with the Javits Amendment, I mean, we actually see terms like male and female, boy and girl, mother and father, both or either. So it's necessarily, I think, indicative of the fact that Congress anticipated a sex binary, right? So we're just looking at the plain text implementing regulations. And of course, the history itself of the law, there were 250 versions of House and Senate education bills that went back and forth between committees before the final language of Title IX was ultimately agreed upon, which indicates to me, and of course, we're going to talk a little bit about sort of what the court has done in other anti-discrimination contexts. But to my mind, Congress had the opportunity to include something, for example, like gender identity, but that would itself, I think, defeat the purpose of sex-based equality within education, because sex is relevant when we want to make sure that there are provision of equal opportunities for both of them. I like to kind of describe this as Title IX being sex prohibitive or Title IX being sex permissive, whereas Title VII is sex prohibitive because sex, of course, unless it's a bona fide occupational qualification, is completely irrelevant to whether or not an individual can do their job. So they really are very different analyses, but it's, I think, very easy for some liberal interpretations to rely very easily on Bostock and say, well, we're dealing with a similar prospect in anti-discrimination law here. And this is a question, again, that the court did not get to in Scrimeti, right? U.S. versus Scrimeti, again, one of the terms marquee cases, whether or not state bans on so-called gender-affirming care for minors were constitutional. They didn't get to whether or not Bostock expands beyond the Title VII context, but they're really going to have to address that head on in this one, aren't they?
I think so. So, they didn't have the issue of Title IX per se before them, but was clearly before them as the Equal Protection Clause in Scrimeti. And they kind of avoided that issue by saying, even if Bostock did apply, the Tennessee law complied with a Bostock type analysis. But they're going to have to reach that issue here, I largely think. And to your point, I think the whole case raises kind of an interesting textual analysis, right? Because Title IX, the statute does not explicitly mention athletics. It doesn't explicitly mention restrooms, right? So how do we get from there to here? And I think the only logical analysis is the Title IX text essentially says you shouldn't be subject to discrimination on the basis of sex. The only way to read that, and given what has happened now, is does not prevent people from taking consideration of sex in certain contexts where sex matters, such as athletics, such as restrooms. Otherwise, if you take a pure Bostock style reading of Title IX, you would invalidate almost all of the regulations that Congress that were initially adopted right after Congress passed Title IX, because many of those regulations, including the regulations on sports, bathrooms, sex-specific sex education classes, all of them permit sex distinctions and even say, hey, essentially do it by group analysis that says you can provide, you know, sex-separated bathrooms as long as they're comparable. Again, that would make no sense in the employment context.
Right.
So, you know, you go back to what's called the canon of a contemporaneous interpretation. Because these regulations were passed and were consistently understood for a long period of time, right after Title IX was passed, I think everyone agreed during that period that that's what Title IX meant and allowed for. And it would really be upsetting the cart and up, you know, to allow, to demand that, you know, Title IX be sex blind. And I think plaintiffs in these cases really understand that. So again, their argument in theory is not, hey, we object to sex separated sports generally. It's just, if you look at just us, if you look at just the plaintiffs, the males who identify as females as an individual, then you have to allow us in. And we can talk about why that's wrong. But I think essentially that is a concession that Title IX allows for sex consciousness in some situations.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, I think we've gotten a couple of pretty good civil rights rulings from the Supreme Court. And while not directly on point, I'm a little hopeful, but I'd love to hear your perspective on this. Ames versus Ohio Department of Youth Services, AJT versus Osseo Area School Districts, these went to burdens of proof, right? Does a majority class plaintiff have to meet a higher burden of proof to prove that their employer is the unlikely individual that would discriminate against a majority class? And the Supreme Court said, no, burden of proof is the same for everybody, because honestly, to find otherwise for one plaintiff versus another based on one of their characteristics would entirely defeat the purpose of anti-discrimination law in the first place. Are you hopeful based on some of the rulings that we've seen kind of at the outer edges of civil rights and civil liberties from the Supreme Court here? And basically, I'm getting here toward textualist readings of the plain text of these actual laws. Are you hopeful that we might be informed a little bit in what we see as the outcome here in these cases?
I mean, I think so. Obviously, the court has been very textualist focused in its analysis most recently. But it's important to stress that it's not a literalist textualism, right? You have to take into consideration context and plain meaning and kind of common language.
Otherwise, we get Bostock.
Yeah, that's right. Otherwise, you kind of have a repeat of Bostock. And so I think that's exactly why it's relevant to look at this long period of time where they passed these regulations. Everyone understood it. It was actually ratified. You know, Title IX had at the time, this is a bit of an unusual procedure where the Jarvis Amendment came in 1974. Congress said, hey, give us these sports regulations. And they had the opportunity to effectively veto them. They declined to do that. So they were essentially adopted, passed around for a long period of time. And in a subsequent case later on, the Supreme Court actually interpreted Title IX in the 1980s, to be very narrow and to define educational program to exclude athletic departments effectively. And then Congress reversed that decision. They passed an amendment and reversed that decision. And I think what you see is they're effectively ratifying all the prior understanding of what Title IX requires in this context of athletics and sports. So that's why I go back to that initial point I made of how there's just some really interesting textual analysis. And this is going to be a test for the court of how we do textualism, right? Do we do it just by, you know, focusing in on one word, or do we look at it broader and say, hey, even the text of Title IX differs than Title VII because it allows for sex distinctions. You know, I'll give you just one more example. I mentioned the regulations, but one provision in the statute of Title IX explicitly allows for what's called a construction rule that says we will, nothing in Title IX should be construed to prohibit sex distinctions in living facilities. Now, again, that's not possible to apply Bostock to that provision and for it to make any sense. So that's just another textual pointer. Once you factor in the regulations, once you factor in the text itself, even the exceptions in Title IX talk about allowing for Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and mother-daughter events versus father-son events, all a very kind of focused defining sex based on biology and allowing for certain distinctions based on sex.
So let me talk a little bit about the Biden era rule and where it stands. We know when it was released in August of 2024, coincidentally, commensurate with the Fourth Circuit's determination in the West Virginia case, this was specifically a real upending of what we understood to be the framework of Title IX, not just the evisceration of due process concerns, not just the implication of essentially forced speech through preferred pronouns, because that, of course, was determined to be sufficient for certain levels of harassment to indicate a violation of Title IX. There were so many manipulations, but for our purposes, focusing strictly on the expansion of sex to include gender identity, that rule was challenged in no fewer than, I believe, 11 federal court rulings, enjoined in every single one of them, vacated by two, went up to the Supreme Court coming out of the sixth in Tennessee versus Department of Education, in which just based on an emergency petition for injunctive relief, the states had argued, listen, we have to get to the point where we can enjoin this rule in the application of these states. The Supreme Court agreed. And interestingly, in the unsigned per curiam order, all the justices uniformly said, we agree that they're entitled to preliminary relief, especially concerning the portion to expand gender to include or sex to include gender identity. Where does that stand now in the midst of the entire landscape against which we're having to interpret what happens with these women's sports cases? Obviously, that rule, that Title IX rule, incentivized sports like West Virginia and Montana to pass women's sports protection acts specifically so that would be shielded from application of what was clearly an expansion of regulatory authority through the Department of Education. So where does that sort of fall into this context?
Yeah, and thankfully, because of those vacator decisions, it's really off the table. You mentioned the 11 lawsuits. I'm proud to say ADF, the group I work for, we were involved in five of them when we won essentially five injunctions. And the two vacator decisions that we're currently involved in, they're actually, at this point, the Trump administration has declined to appeal those, which we think is the right thing. Interveners have sought to intervene in the case to appeal them. So technically, those cases are not totally finalized. But the vacators, which vacating the Biden rule, and as you note, the Biden rule essentially tried to put Bostock into the regulations and incorporate that into Title IX. So because those things have been vacated, they're off the table. What's really, I think, the challenge is another thing you note is, you know, kind of the split amongst the lower courts of how do we interpret, even forgetting the Biden Title IX rule, how do we interpret Title IX generally? Do we interpret it in a Bostock type way? The Ninth Circuit, the Fourth Circuit, the Seventh Circuit have said yes. Or do we reject that essentially as the Sixth Circuit, the 11th Circuit have both said, and that's really the issue on the table. And to take us back, I think it's useful because one of the arguments made in these cases at the Ninth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit is essentially that, look, there was no need for these laws, that these laws were really targeting people who identify as transgender because everyone knows that Title IX allows sex-separated sports. So this is really almost like an animus-type gerrymander. But, both the legislative histories cite situations across the country where males who identify as females were competing in women's sports and winning. One case that we're involved in Connecticut, I think it was the first women's sports type issue, where you saw two males compete in high school athletics in Connecticut, and I think eventually won 15 state women's titles. We represented four women and filed a lawsuit saying that violated Title IX. We filed that lawsuit in 2019. And so at that time, 2019, 2020, there was a lot of confusion amongst policymakers, amongst school officials, amongst sports officials about how, what is required under Title IX. That is really when states stepped in and started passing these Women's Sports Act. Idaho was the first one in the nation in 2020, West Virginia in 2021. And then now you see 27 states total have passed these laws. So our argument would be that these are not, responding randomly or in any way singling out people who identify as the opposite sex, but they were responding to a natural result of men taking away women's opportunities in sports. And that's what necessitated the legislatures to step in and respond. And nothing in the laws make any distinction based on gender identity. All they simply do is say, look, there's men's teams, there's women's teams, there are co-ed teams, and males, defined biologically, cannot compete in women's sports. Gender identity is totally irrelevant to that analysis because gender identity does not affect your physiological ability. What does is your biological sex. And that's, again, these laws are just tracking Title IX and focusing on biology and physiology, not gender identity. And I think that makes good sense.
Let's talk a little bit about severability. And you and I had talked about this right before we started, but there are really two big issues right now when it comes to Title IX litigation. One is sports, naturally, but the other is bathrooms. And one of the issues, one of the advancing sort of positions that the Biden administration had achieved or argued for within their litigation, their defense to the litigation, the onslaught of requests for injunctive relief was to say, okay, as concerns this portion of sex to include gender identity, fine. We agree to actually enjoining that portion, but what if we just keep the rest of the law going? What we're trying to, I think, parse out now, and I think a lot of people who are watching this are going to be keenly interested in, is what's happening in the bathroom space. We've got conflicting circuit court precedent, right? The Fourth Circuit and the Grimm versus Gloucester County School Board decision actually determined that bathrooms could be essentially open to anyone based on gender identity. And to hold otherwise was a violation of both equal protection and Title IX. And then we have a conflicting outcome coming out of the 11th Circuit in the Adams versus St. John County School Board case that specifically said precisely the opposite. A panel of the Third Circuit, Barbara Lagoa, writing for the court, actually completely held the analysis to be a different one, requiring under Title IX the separation of bathrooms to hold otherwise would to be rendering the educational opportunities unequal for these biological girls. So where does the bathroom litigation play into this? How will the outcomes in the West Virginia and Idaho cases, how are they actually going to move forward on the sort of question of whether or not bathrooms can also be separated based on sex?
I think they're going to play an important role, and it really comes down to that textual analysis. You know, if Bostock comes into Title IX, that's going to affect not just sports, but private spaces, and not just bathrooms. But I'd note that, again, showers, overnight accommodations, think about traveling on sports teams, locker rooms, things like that. And again, the ultimate question is, does Title IX, either for sports or for private spaces, does it allow sex distinctions, or does it, does it force males who identify as women into those spaces in the name of stopping sex discrimination? So I think it is going to play an important role. And as you know, this is changing rapidly. The Seventh Circuit had before this had said you have to allow males who identify as females in women's restrooms. It's now reconsidering that decision after Scrimeti. There is a pending emergency petition at the U.S. Supreme Court right now coming out of the Fourth Circuit on the bathroom issue. We're not sure what the court's going to do with that. It just got filed, I think, even last week. And there's actually another current emergency motion pending appeal out of the Ninth Circuit on the bathroom issue. We, ADF, has helped represent Idaho in that case. And we won at the Ninth Circuit against a facial attack. And then now we've won again at the district court on a more as-applied challenge just to the bathrooms and not to showers and other areas. So things are constantly changing. And I think that was one of the hope for the reason of the court to take these two decisions is to provide clarity, not just on the sports issue, but on the bathroom issue. Because again, Title IX explicitly doesn't reference restrooms or showers, right? But there's a regulation that allows for that, much like there's a separate sports regulation. So if you start with first principles, you really almost have to play out the analysis similarly. You're either going to say, hey, Title IX allows for these sex distinctions, or you're going to take a kind of case-by-case approach and say, no, Title IX requires you to allow males who identify as the opposite sex into these spaces.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the emergency petition right now in the Doe versus South Carolina case, right? So this is coming out of the Fourth Circuit. And again, it's tackling Grimm versus Gloucester County School Board head on, which remains, of course, binding precedent in the Fourth Circuit. And that's exactly why the Fourth Circuit determined, as it did, that bathrooms that separated by biological sex were a violation of Title IX and the Equal Protection Clause. So the state petitioner here has asked basically the Supreme Court to weigh in, saying that it disrupts the status quo in a preliminary posture in a case where the plaintiffs are unlikely to prevail. Now, would you consider them unlikely to prevail based on the fact that we've now seen a cert grant in the two women's sports cases? And we've obviously got a little bit of clarity from the Supreme Court on distinctions and the state's ability to legislate for the safety and welfare of their own citizens coming out of the Scrimeti decision. What do you think happens in Doe versus South Carolina in this emergency petition?
Yeah, it's always hard sometimes to predict what happens on the emergency docket. I mean, you could see, obviously, the court has a lot of options, right? It could grant and then hold in light of the what it decides to do in the BPJ case, because the Fourth Circuit in the South Carolina case cited the BPJ decision and the Grimm decision as part of its analysis. Or I could say too soon, or maybe the balance of the equities are not favoring going to the emergency docket. It's a bit hard to predict. I am hopeful on the merits. As you noted, the Supreme Court on the Biden Title IX rule already addressed this issue on the emergency docket, and every justice agreed. They unanimously agreed that the states and the clients that we were representing in that situation, in those cases, that were likely to prevail on the merits, that Bostock did not apply to Title IX. So it's really going to be an interesting case to see what the court does and how it balances what it thinks about the merits versus this type of procedural posture. I am just very hopeful on the core merits issue, whether you look at it in the private spaces or the sports spaces, that we're ultimately going to win the day. I think as the court essentially gave a forecast to in that earlier emergency docket decision in Louisiana versus Department of Education.
Yeah. We've got a question that I want your perspective on from Michael, who asks whether or not you guys have done any litigation in Massachusetts in a Title IX suit, because specifically in Massachusetts, the state's Equal Rights Amendment has been interpreted to give all biological males the right to participate in women's sports like swimming and field hockey, where there are no men's teams. Now, I have an answer to this, and I think it's germane to kind of what we're seeing now in the litigation Department of Justice has against the state of Maine in the First Circuit and against the state of California out in the Ninth Circuit. There's a supremacy clause issue here, but I'm interested as to your take. Have you experienced any of this in Massachusetts? What's your answer as to whether or not a state equal rights amendment can trump what's clearly the congressional history and plain text of Title IX?
Yeah, so absolutely not. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that Title IX as a supremacy clause issue would trump any local state laws. And I think what there's actually playing out, we don't have any litigation in Massachusetts per se, but we do have litigation in Minnesota, and New Hampshire, and I mentioned the Soul case, where what you see in some of these blue states is policy saying you have to allow males into women's sports based on gender identity and not based on biological sex. So effectively, what they're doing is turning women's teams into co-ed teams, right? If you make it based on pure gender identity. And in these states, they don't even require, for example, a rule that says you have to take hormone therapy for a certain period of time. It's purely based on an internal sense of self. Do you have this professional identity? Then you can go into the women's sports team. And we have argued in those cases, and there are other cases that have made this argument, Seoul being, the most prominent one, is that you can't effectively turn a women's sports team into a co-ed team. That violates Title IX. This goes back, the regulations themselves, they say that states may provide separate sports teams, but then they go on to say that states or schools that receive federal funding, they must provide equal opportunity for women in the sports context. So once you take that assumption that, A, that males have physiological advantages as a general matter, then you couldn't essentially eradicate women's sports or declare that there can't be women's sports without taking away those equal opportunities from women. And so that is going to be one of the next issues that courts are going to address. Not only can states designate teams by sex, but must they to comply with Title IX?
Right, right. Let me switch to our equal protection discussion a little bit, and then we'll allow other people a chance to weigh in with additional questions. But I do want to get to the second half of the equation, right? Because we've talked extensively about Title IX relative to bathrooms and sports and some of the conflicting case law that we're seeing right now. But let's go to the constitutional question, because while similar, it is a completely different analysis here, and the court's going to have to weigh different factors. So talk a little bit about what the Supreme Court has traditionally held when it comes to heightened scrutiny scrutiny, right? Intermediate level of scrutiny, more than rational basis, less than strict scrutiny, and protected classes. Traditionally, we've relied on that bright line of immutable characteristics for an analysis here. Do you think, based on the court's history, that they're likely or unlikely to recognize transgender status as a new sort of suspect or quasi-suspect class?
Well, I think it's pretty unlikely given what was said in the Scrimeti decision. So that wasn't addressed head on by the majority in the Scrimeti decision, but the concurrences, Justice Alito, Justice Barrett, I think most interestingly said that they did not think that transgender identity was a protected class because it's not immutable. People can change their gender identity. It's not discrete. You have gender identity be someone can identify as male or female or non-binary or many other gender identities that can change over time. And I think along those same lines, but it's interesting, Justice Barrett said that we should actually look at not just has there been private discrimination against a group, but has there been de jure legal discrimination
right
over time against groups. So that will be an interesting issue to see play out. But to take a step back, the first issue is, does the law even make a distinction based on gender identity? Which right. we don't think it does, because again, the law's plain text just says you need to designate sport teams by sex. So gender identity is irrelevant. But then it goes on that second, the backup argument being, even if it does make a distinction based on gender identity, is that a protected class? As you know, the way we've historically done equal protection analysis, it's interesting that, the 14th Amendment does not mention sex or discriminate based on sex. The court has traditionally done kind of an anti-discrimination norm via the equal protection clause and has divided up based on, is this a protected class? Like race is the classic example. And if it hits a protected class, it gets a heightened level of scrutiny. So for women, it's by our sex, it said that it does this medium level of scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny, because the court has acknowledged that sometimes it's appropriate and right to make sex distinctions, but sometimes it's not. And I think that tracks our prior argument regarding Title IX. I do want to put a pin on one interesting issue in the equal protection analysis is really focused on how you do equal protection analysis and intermediate scrutiny, facial versus as applied. Yeah. So as I noted before, everyone here agrees that the states can make distinctions based on sex generally in sports. For example, let's say you had a male who identifies as male come in and want to play on the women's sports team. Everyone admits that would comply with equal protection to prevent that male. So plaintiff's response to that argument is, well, look, if you just look at us individually, we take cross-sex hormones or we haven't gone through puberty. So if you look at our particular situation, our particular facts, because we have the same athletic ability as women, you have to allow us in because it doesn't further your interests to prevent us from playing women's sports if we have the same athletic ability. Now, we dispute those facts on a law. We think that athletic ability by males is retained even after puberty blockers. Mm-hmm. But I think the interesting legal question is, does that even matter for intermediate scrutiny? So for strict scrutiny, it's well accepted that every application of the law has to further the interest in the law. They have to be the least restrictive means. It has to be the narrowest tailored thing possible. But for intermediate scrutiny, that's generally not the case. It's just whether the law generally serves your interests. And so let me give you an example. I think we can imagine scenarios where a male who identifies as male just has low athletic ability, or maybe they have a disability, or maybe they, are taking some type of drugs that lowers their testosterone level. Could the state exclude those males from women's sports despite their taking those medications? I think the answer is clearly yes, they can. So why should the analysis be different in this situation? We think it shouldn't be, because again, the way intermediate scrutiny typically works is you ask, does the general classification generally work, right? You don't ask, does it work in every single scenario, every single application? So I think that's going to be an interesting thing the court will give guidance on, is how to do equal protection analysis generally and intermediate scrutiny. Do you focus on the general classification, or do you have to focus on each individual? And if you have to focus on each individual, that's really going to make sex-separated sports impossible, right? Because you're going to have to look at each person,
every single one,
every person, every different sport, all the person's, you know, medical history, their physical ability. What it effectively would do, it would prevent states from making sex distinctions and require them to do a case-by-case physical ability analysis for each individual. And we just don't think that that's how you do equal protection analysis.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, it's interesting. You were talking initially about the distinctions made in these particular state laws. And if a law distinguishes based on sex, it can't distinguish based on transgender status. Naturally, it has to disregard transgender status. But even if it did consider transgender status, it would seem to me that even if we argue for the sake of, you know, sort of a rhetorical exercise, that it did consider transgender status and it did consider these individuals to be part of a quasi-suspect or a suspect class sufficient for heightened scrutiny analysis, could a state meet heightened scrutiny analysis based on the interests of the biological women who were also playing in these teams?
Yeah, no, I definitely think so. And I think that goes back to the point of like, what level of generality are you looking at? Are you looking at the general classification? Or are you looking at the specific? Now, we think we meet both. And that goes back to one of the disputes in the case between the parties is if you look at the particular males in these cases, you know, whether they take hormone therapy or whether they haven't gone through puberty, do they retain a physical advantage? We argue yes. But that goes to the point of even if they don't, can the state make a general classification that men and women are not similarly situated? Yeah. And for athletic purposes, you know, to think about it, another way to think about it is because the classification is based on sex, how often is that accurate? Well, it's accurate 95% of the time. Yeah. So, you know, or even 99% of the time. So we would argue that that easily meets intermediate scrutiny. And, you know, we shouldn't forget that the proof is in the pudding here, right? That if you read, I think the lower court opinions is actually pretty interesting because they say, look, there's no proof that men will compete in women's sports in these states. I think that has turned out absolutely false. And if you just read the news, you see report after report after report. So if anything, Idaho and West Virginia have been proven absolutely correct of the need for these laws. And to put a particular pin on it, we can even look at West Virginia. The male athlete there in West Virginia has already beaten women, I think, over 250 times, separate women. And those numbers are continuing to increase over time. So you do see these reports. And given that you have this type of evidence that if you, you know, if you don't make sex distinction in sports, that you are going to have women losing out opportunities, podium placements, scholarships, that the states are absolutely able to meet their burden to show these laws further a substantial interest in protecting women.
You know, it's interesting. We talked a little bit about, you know, puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, sort of the muting of any potential athletic advantages. I think the science is pretty clear based on what you and I understand to be the case and the extensive reading and writing that we've done in this space that, you know, there are some characteristics that simply cannot be muted by hormonal modification one way or the other, whether it's wingspan, muscle mass, faster muscle twitch response, bone density, or the like. These are particular questions for which there is sort of competing scientific analysis. Now, I think it's fairly clear, but, you know, there are other perspectives. Individuals would say, you know, you really do rule out a lot of these athletic advantages if you have an individual pre-puberty starting on these cross-sex hormones or these puberty blockers, and then they should be able to compete on level footing with biological females, even though they're biologically male. These are kinds of the questions of public policy debate and scientific analysis that, to my mind, seem very likely to enter into the Dobbs-Scrimeti analysis. I can just sort of hear the words of Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito ringing in my head when they said questions, you know, hotly debated questions of public policy should be left to the democratic process, to the people and its elected representatives. Do you think those kinds of questions will come up in this analysis for the court as well?
Yeah, I think so. I think the part in Scrimeti that kind of rings in my mind is they talked about how in the medical context that you almost need to make certain sex distinctions, right, for things to work. And that's the whole purpose of, you know, you have to look at the whole argument in Scrimeti was this law makes a distinction based on age and diagnosis, not based on sex. Well, in some ways that has the same ring in the context of privacy and athletics, because sex matters. It matters a lot to who wins and loses. So I think you will see the court be hesitant to say you have to allow a male into women's sports. And I think this is one of the problems, I think, particularly with the Fourth Circuit opinion. So to be clear, what the Fourth Circuit did is it ruled, it entered summary judgment for the plaintiffs on the Title IX claim, but actually on the equal protection claim, it remanded and said, hey, there's a dispute of fact about whether the particular plaintiff had a physiological advantage. But what that effectively means is that issue is irrelevant for the Title IX issue, that even if BPJ in the situation or other males have a physical advantage, that Title IX requires you to allow them into women's sports. And that is a pretty far-reaching analysis. Again, what it effectively does, it tracks those states, those blue states that have said, look, you have to allow anyone in based on their internal sense of self, their gender identity alone, regardless of whether they take cross-sex hormones or have gone through puberty or anything like that. It totally depended on that. So throughout this case, you have a bit of an interesting kind of conflict, I think, for some of the plaintiffs' arguments. On the one hand, they want to focus on gender identity as the sole determiner. On the other hand, they want to focus on what type of medical treatment you receive. And does that level the playing field? And you can't really have it both ways, right? Either gender identity makes you equivalent. And if that's, you know, the case, then you don't have the same physical abilities. Or if you have to take, you know, cross-sex hormones or hormone therapy to equalize the playing field, well, people can take those type of drugs for any type of reason. For, as I noted, you need to have the example of someone who's taking, you know, chemotherapy, for example, and has to take various drugs that lessen their physical abilities. That doesn't mean the state has to let them in to women's sports, because again, if you start with the right premise, which I think is the right way to do the analysis, you look at the classification generally, and does it generally further the state's interests? And here everyone agrees that as a general matter, the state should be able to limit women's sports to women, then it should just follow naturally that they should be able to apply that in particular situations to males.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think this is really at bottom, it's a question about, again, sort of operation of the democratic process, right? Once again, it's just sort of the same ilk, I would think, of the Dobbs and Scrimeti type decisions where, again, does a state have an ability to democratically enact pursuant to the people's will through their elected representatives, particular legislation designed to protect vulnerable populations and to ensure the equality of all of them? And I think the clear answer to that in the end is yes, although I harken back to Justice Thomas's opinion in Scrimeti, in which he said, you know, this is part of the problem when we're talking about these, you know, so-called sort of purveyors of gender medicine and so-called gender affirming care, what we sort of stand to lose when we defer to the so-called expert class. And I think there's kind of a similar discussion here that we're likely to possibly encounter when it comes to individuals who are talking about the absence of athletic advantage when it comes to these biological men and women's sports. But I do think it's something that'll ultimately come up in time. There is another question we have. Dan asks, how could Title IX require the separation of bathrooms, locker rooms, or showers by gender identity? If the statute didn't allow separation by sex, wouldn't it require co-ed facilities regardless of gender identity?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of our argument and part of the discussion we're having, that that one reason why it doesn't make much sense to import Bostock into Title IX, because it has these far-reaching implications. You know, to try to get a sense of the other side's argument, I think their argument is like, look, Bostock looked at the literal language because of sex in Title VII. It's similar language in Title IX. So you have to do what's called the but-for cause analysis. Does the government action turn on someone's sex? Does it notice someone's sex? And they would say, well, clearly, if you exclude a male who identifies as a female, that turns on someone's sex. And therefore, Bostock should apply. And that's why include gender identity. Another, I think, interesting argument embraced by the lower courts in this case, which is really interesting, is to say effectively that the very definition of biological sex discriminates based on transgender persons. And so that goes back to my point of the lower courts have said that this is essentially a gerrymandered definition. That it targets By definition, if you define sex biologically, you're not defining sex by gender identity, and therefore it discriminates based on gender identity. I think that's a bit circular. And I think it's pretty radical, because what that would mean is it would essentially conflate the two concepts and make it impossible to ever make a distinction based on biological sex. And in that respect, this is probably the case that's closest to the legal issue of, you know, what is a woman, right? When we're litigating the case, the BPJ case, we lost at the preliminary injunction stage at the district court, but we actually convinced the district court at summary judgment to reverse himself and to uphold the law, which is pretty unusual.
Yeah.
And he framed that analysis of, you know, essentially this case decides, like, what is the meaning of sex? What is the meaning of a woman? And that obviously raises very important legal ramifications, cultural ramifications, of where the court will go with it. But it just highlights that it's a bit of an unusual challenge that the plaintiffs are bringing, because they're not challenging sex distinctions generally. They're challenging the definition of what it means, of what sex means. So it'll be interesting to see how the court analyzes that.
Yeah, I think so as well. Seeing no further questions from the audience, this has been a great discussion. Again, probably to my mind, you know, there's another very big case that I'm keen to sort of watch the outcome in Childs versus Salazar, also an ADF case that I'm very much looking forward to. But to my mind, this is sort of, you know, the tip of the spear when it comes to the court's term. We don't have oral arguments yet scheduled, do we?
No, we do have oral arguments. I think our intuition is the arguments will probably happen in January. That's what we're expecting, just given the amount of cases the court's accepted so far. But we haven't have a firm date. We're hopeful that they'll probably be set on the same day, back to back. And that way the court can address all these important issues that we've been talking about that have really been percolating in the lower courts for over a decade, parents, students. I think the one issue that everyone agrees on is that we need clarity on this issue.
Yeah.
And because it's affecting, you know, school starting back up for so many of us, it's really affecting kids and particularly women and girls across the country. And I think the court was right to step in and really set the record straight that Title IX and equal protection, they do allow for protecting women, providing equal opportunities in athletics.
I think so too. Seeing no further questions from the audience, Marco, I can kick it back over to you.
Well, thank you both for that fantastic discussion and the benefit of your time and expertise today. On behalf of the Federal Society, I'd also like to thank you, our audience, for joining us. We greatly appreciate your participation. For information on more upcoming events, please visit our website or all major social media platforms at FedSoc. On that note, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.